Well, let me start tonight by saying that those of you who saw the film and then heard my description last night of the vision I have of the ending of this play must have been a little bit puzzled, because they seem to be two very different things. And I sincerely believe that the end of The Merchant of Venice, as is the case with almost all the Shakespeare comedies, ends with a vision that connects us to the hope for paradise. That's why I invoked the wedding feast of Cana at the end, that notion of earthly joy, but it is earthly joy that is directly connected with the possibility, the very real possibility, and the hope of heaven. And my vision of the end of the play is that Shakespeare takes us back to Belmont, so that this play can end in that that beautiful kingdom on top of the beautiful mountain, the slightly fabulous land, but it's real in its way, because all of the characters have somehow suffered or undergone some sort of challenge in the course of the play, and so by the time they come to the conclusion, they've earned that happy ending. They all deserve to be there. They have, in one way or another, proven themselves worthy of participating in that joyous conclusion. And so what we get at the end is the music, the moonlight, the joking back and forth, Jessica and Lorenzo joking back and forth as they evoke memories of famous lovers from the past and then begin to be slightly critical of each other in a lighthearted tone. The little trick of the ring that then Portia brings up with Pisanio, that Nerissa teases Gratiano with, and of course the good fortune of the ships literally coming in. Antonio's fortune is restored, and the night ends with the married couples off to bed. The sense of the joy of conjugality, and the hope for future, for children, that the kingdom will now be populated. And in that sense, again, Belmont is going to become a little world unto itself, where before there was the solitary princess and her maid, we now have three married couples, a very wealthy man who is friend to them all, and the hope of lots of children. So that it is a beautiful vision of the joys of faith and hope and charity extending outward. That's not what you saw. That's not what you saw in the production that you watched the other night. What happens there is this. From the beginning, Jessica is upset. She's troubled by something. The little exchange with Lorenzo is pointed. When they have their little disagreement, it turns serious. By the time Portia returns, the moonlight is gone. The sun has come up, as I said. We're suddenly in the clarity of daylight. The little joke about the rings isn't as funny in daylight as it is in moonlight. It doesn't seem quite as fantastic. It's not quite as romantic. Antonio gets his fortune back. His ships come in. But Jessica is becoming more and more alienated from this crowd. And then, as two of the couples go in, and Lorenzo prepares to go in by himself, his wife looks at a letter that she has been given, reads the letter, is struck by something serious, and we hear a different music being sung in the background, and it's the music of the Kaddish, the Jewish prayer for the dead. What we are to imply from this is clearly, her father is dead. We don't know if it's because he was crushed to death with the heavy punishment that weighed him down so that his life was gone from him, or if it's a suicide, that he could not face such treatment anymore and took his own life. The implication is, in any case, he is dead, and she feels the pang of guilt, and she cannot be part of that happy ending. What do we get at the end of that vision of the play? We do not get a happy ending. What we get at the end of the play is the troubles and sorrows of the world, specifically as they have landed on Shylock, who is now somehow a sacrificial victim to these selfish, thoughtless, hard-hearted people who are off partying at this point without any sense of what they've done to this poor man, and his daughter is now trapped there among them with the weight of sorrow that she has betrayed her father. You don't end a comedy that way. That is not a comic ending. That is not the wedding feast of Cana. That is the suffering of the Jewish people that replaces, totally swamps, the joy of Christ's promise in the wedding feast of Cana. Christ is removed from the ending of the play. The vision of Christian joy is gone from the end of the comedy. And it is not permitted because there are Jews out there who are suffering. It is not accidental that the production of the play was done. It was filmed about 1972. And it's simply a historical fact. I refer you to a recent book by a man named Finkelstein called The Holocaust Industry, which says that the whole notion of the Holocaust, the very term itself, being central to our understanding of World War II, begins to develop in the late 60s and early 70s. One of the finest historians of that period, a man named John Lukacs, in his book called The Hitler of History, makes the following statement. There seemed to be no general or popular interest in the Holocaust for many years. Indeed, for about two decades. The very word Holocaust did not begin to appear in American or English usage until the late 1960s. For reasons that are not easy to assess, the intensity of preoccupation with the Holocaust began to grow rapidly only after that time, especially among American Jews. Now, it's a British production, but the interest is there. And what we have is a production of The Merchant of Venice that insists on the suffering of Shylock. And, of course, Olivier is a fine actor. You will recall that moment, and it's an unforgettable moment. He leaves the courtroom, or in this case, sort of the boardroom where that confrontation takes place. He goes out, and we hear the scream from outside. This is a soul in agony. So it makes sense that then by Act 5, his life has been snuffed out. What do we have? The fact of the suffering at the hands of those people who call themselves Christian, and that suffering is what must dominate. And that suffering cannot be forgotten. And that suffering will not allow the happy ending. And that terrible betrayal and pain cannot be forgotten. Even if you're back at Belmont, even if you're happily married, even if you're going off to your wedding bed, Because that suffering brought upon that Jewish man obliterates what I would call the Catholic ending of the play. Now, that's what I want to examine. How do we get there? How does it happen? And is it in any way what Shakespeare intended? Well, let me start with this and put The Merchant of Venice in context with the other comedies that Shakespeare wrote at about the same time. This play, written, 1595, 1596, is right at the moment when Shakespeare is turning out his greatest comedies. It is early in his career. It is what sometimes is simply called the comic period in his playwriting career. And he goes from The Merchant of Venice to write some additional glorious comedies. Much Ado About Nothing, As You Like It, Twelfth Night. And all of those plays have certain patterns. One of them I mentioned last night. They are all about the difficulty of finding real love. That is, how do you judge the appropriate partner, the good partner. How do you make a good marriage? Comedy's always about that. The best comedies, very often, most about that. And the greatest comedies that follow Shakespeare. The comic novels of Jane Austen, the comic operas of Mozart, something like The Marriage of Figaro. Those glorious comedies, all of them still somehow Christian comedy. That question of marriage, how do you make a good determination? How do you find a good partner? In the midst of that struggle, which is a struggle of individual happiness and the social order, as I said last night, there is a figure that appears in every one of those comedies. And I want to look at the pattern here. Merchant of Venice is first, okay? And I'm simply going to call this character the outsider. Okay? A figure who simply doesn't fit in. Is somehow outside the social order from the beginning of the play, is aware of that position, is somehow troubled in turbulent emotion because of being outside, and resentful against all of those who comprise the social order. So, Merchant of Venice, that figure very clearly is Shylock. The next play, Much Ado About Nothing. The figure is called Don John. Okay, he's the villain of the piece. The play that follows that, the pastoral comedy As You Like It, and the figure there named Jaques. And finally, Twelfth Night, the last of this series of great comedies. Twelfth Night, and the figure is Malvolio. Now, the pattern is consistent through the four plays. As we have, usually, young men and young women trying to find a suitable marriage partner, find workable love that will allow them to marry and become part of the social order, there's a figure who is, from the start, outside the social order. There is something in each one that sets the character apart. Shylock is Jewish. Don John in Much Ado About Nothing is a bastard. I'm not commenting on his character, it's just the fact. He's illegitimate, okay? And therefore, clearly not part of the social order. Jaques is a cynic. He is outside deliberately because his philosophical stance is that of the cynic. And he simply wanders through the forest of Arden where everyone else is falling in love and cracks jokes at their expense. He sneers at love. And finally, in Twelfth Night, Malvolio is a Puritan. Very closed in, very narrow. There's going to be no fun. Nobody's going to have any fun. And he's going to see to it. Out of it comes the great line where he gets up in the middle of the night because Sir Toby Belch, one of Shakespeare's great characters, you can know what his weakness is by the name, Sir Toby Belch and his friend Sir Andrew Aguecheek and the clown Festy are up in the middle of the night and they've been tippling too much and they're singing. And Malvolio comes storming in. What do you mean, singing, waking the house at this hour of the night? I won't have it. And Sir Toby's response is, "Dost thou think because thou art virtuous, there shall be no more cakes and ale?" just because you're virtuous all the time, I can have a drink and something to eat. It's marvelous. It's just marvelous. But Malvolio is the one who is shutting down the fun. So what do we have here? Each one of these figures, an outsider, I'm looking at a pattern that runs through all the comedies. The Jew in Venice, the bastard in Messina in Sicily, the cynic in the Forest of Arden where everyone's falling in love, and the Puritan in the household where everybody's celebrating, where we're trying to have a good time. If we look again, what have we got here? We have outsiders who are outsiders either because of their social position, that is by birth, or what they believe in terms of philosophy, because Jaques fashions himself a philosopher, or religion, the Puritan and the Jew. There is not at all a train of scholarship or criticism dealing with the other comedies that says Shakespeare hated Puritans. Shakespeare would have nothing to do with Puritans. Shakespeare showed how shallow and corrupt he was, how his heart was filled with hate because he presents a Puritan in a critical matter. What everyone says is that Shakespeare seems to have seen that there were certain problems with Puritans and creates Malvolio, who is a not terribly likable figure, but gets punished, gets rather severely punished, and reacts badly to his punishment. We've got Jaques, who simply at the end of the play decides it's not worth it. Everyone's engaged in happy marriages all around, and he can't stand it, and just says he's going to retire off to a cave somewhere and live by himself. There is no sense that Shakespeare was unfair to those who were cynical, whose philosophical view was dark, and that therefore he was narrow-minded. It's just that Shakespeare is critical of the point of view of cynicism, of the older cynic when it comes to young love. Don John, mean-spirited, causes terrible trouble. No one says Shakespeare was so narrow-minded that he thought that all bastards should be thrown into prison. And not at all. This guy's really nasty and causes terrible trouble, and partially because of his social position. But in fact, what Shakespeare is going to do is just a few years later create another character who's a bastard, who's truly evil, named Edmund in King Lear. But we're going to understand very clearly that there are reasons why Edmund is so filled with anger and hatred. We don't get them here. So that Shakespeare will go on and give a rather different view. But it's not that Shakespeare was somehow against all of those people who were unfortunate enough to be born outside of the marriage bonds. Shylock's the outsider. He's a Jew. But because he's an outsider, and because he gets a kind of punishment, the way Don John does, the way Malvolio does, because he is separated from the society at the end, the way Malvolio is, the way Jaques is, the way Don John is, Shakespeare is anti-Semitic. Boom, there it is, pronouncement. Well, it doesn't work that way. Let's talk a bit about this. Fact of the matter is that at the time Shakespeare is writing the play, there were not many Jews in England. He wasn't particularly acquainted with them. They'd been expelled by Edward I in the year 1290. We're talking 300 years later. So that the Jews who were present in England at this time when he's writing the play are for the most part those who have converted or are making the claim of having converted. They are not large in number. So he's writing about something that he may not have an immediate knowledge of. So if we're making the claim that he had this deep-seated hatred, it had to be against people who really weren't there at the time. In the same way, his racism, so-called, is a curious factor. At that point, there were almost no blacks in London at all, and in fact there was an enormous uproar when indeed a Moorish general came and visited, because they hadn't seen a black. And shortly thereafter we also get Othello, the Moor of Venice, who is a tragic hero, who is granted incredible nobility and dignity, but who makes a choice and falls. So if he was genuinely hating those of a different skin color, he had to be doing it in his head because he hadn't spent much time with them. And again, there was a recent case that had taken place that had brought the question of Jews to the forefront. There had been a famous trial shortly before the play was written. in which a doctor, a Portuguese Jew named Dr. Rodrigo Lopez, had been accused of trying to poison Queen Elizabeth. It was a sensational case. He had been her physician. The debate still goes on as to whether or not he was guilty. Some who were his servants, who knew him well, testified that yes, indeed, they were aware of the fact he had attempted to poison the queen. Others said he was innocent. We don't know. It was a sensational case. He was convicted. He was hanged. So there was some sense of mistrust because he at that time was probably the most prominent Jewish figure in London, and there is a veiled reference to it in the courtroom scene in Act 4, Scene 1, Merchant of Venice, Graziano speaking. One of his outbursts against Shylock, "O be thou damned inexorable dog, and for thy life let justice be accused. Thou almost makest me waver in my faith to hold opinion with Pythagoras, that souls of animals infuse themselves into the trunks of men. Thy currish spirit governed a wolf who, hanged for human slaughter, even from the gallows did his fell soul fleet, and whilst thou layest in thy unhallowed dam, infused itself in thee." They used to, on occasion, hang animals. Okay? If a dog had committed a particularly outrageous act, they would hang the animal. Hence our phrase, he's got a hangdog look. That's where it comes from. So the vision here is that what Graziano is saying, well, they hanged a wolf recently and the spirit transmigrated out of the wolf into you. But of course, Lopez, is a name very similar to wolf in meaning. And there may be that veiled reference that the audience probably would have caught. So there was this small measure there. That was the most prominent case. But I quote W.H. Auden in an essay on The Merchant of Venice, who says, "What prejudice against the Jews existed among Elizabethans, it was not racial." He also makes the point very clearly. The most important thing about Shylock is not that he is a Jew or a heretic, but that he is an outsider, again. As I tried to establish a pattern through all of the comedies, it's in all of them. Now, that being the case, how would he have been treated then? What I want to do now is go back to the play and look at how the dramatist presents him, okay? Because part of what we're dealing with here, and this is a very old-fashioned idea, I apologize for pursuing it, but I'm very old-fashioned, is that the author has an intent. That the playwright, when he sits down to write, means something. This is, we've evolved beyond that now in my field of literary studies, where if the author had an intent, we can't really know it, and it certainly is not as important as what the reader may find there. So that the reader deconstructs the work and reconstructs it according to whatever the reader wants to make of it. The reader becomes the new writer. The old writer was just one more of many people who have looked at this work. He just happened to be the one who put it down. That's how loopy the whole thing's gotten. In any case, I am assuming that the author had an intent. How can we know it? Well, let's go to the very beginning. Let's go to the very beginning. And we can say, as I said last night, and it's a simple fact, the play is not called The Jew of Venice. There was indeed a famous play by Christopher Marlowe written shortly before this called The Jew of Malta. And if you want to see a stereotypical Jew presented, read that play and see how Marlowe presents Barnabas. Whoa! And you'll get a measure of how what we get in this play, although very clearly, I think, presented in a fashion in which Shylock is meant to be, certainly, if not a villain, the problem of the piece, he still has a measure of humanity to him. He is a much more rounded character than the character presented by Marlowe in the Jew of Malta. We first meet Shylock, Act 1, Scene 3. Bassanio has come to him to make the proposal, 3,000 ducats. That's what he wants to borrow. It is Antonio that will be bound. Shylock is speculating on it. And then Antonio, at about line 35, enters. And we have the first meeting between the merchant and the Jew. And as soon as Antonio comes in, and this is important, because Shakespeare always, in all of his plays, gives us some sense of how we are to view characters by how other characters speak of them. And Antonio is praised by everyone throughout the play as a good man. Antonio comes in, Bassanio says, "This is Signor Antonio," and Shylock immediately has an aside. Before he speaks to Antonio, he comes down and speaks directly to the audience. I would say this is dramatist's intent, okay? And what does he say when the title character, called a good man by everyone, walks in? How like a fawning publican he looks. "I hate him, for he is a Christian." Well, that's pretty clear. The relationship is established. Shylock hates Antonio. But more, okay, first I hate him for because he's a Christian, but more than that, but more, for that in low simplicity he lends out money gratis and brings down the rate of usance here with us in Venice. I hate him because he's a Christian, but I really hate him because he loans money without charging interest. And as a result, the interest rates keep coming down. I can't charge a 26% fee on the credit cards, okay? Ah, I got some competition and I can only charge 9%. Ah, okay? "If I can catch him once upon the hip, I will feed fat the ancient grudge I bear him." Well, it's pretty clear. He hasn't even talked to him yet. He's already plotting what? His destruction. And critics claim this is the heroic, noble figure in the play. He hates our sacred nation. And he rails, even there where merchants most do congregate, on me, my bargains, and my well-run thrift, which he calls interest. He hates Antonio, and he says, and he hates me, but then we learn the reasons. Because what? On me, my bargains, and my well-won thrift, which he calls interest. We've got a couple of businessmen at each other's throats. And then Shylock continues, "Cursed be my tribe if I forgive him." And it's very clear, forgiveness is not part of Shylock's understanding. Now, gotta say this, and it's absolutely true. We learn that Antonio's detestation of Shylock runs pretty deep. And indeed, Shylock says, "Signor Antonio, many a time and often the Rialto have you rated me about my monies and my usances." Okay? We encounter in public and you go after me about the fact that I'm charging interest on loans. "Still have I borne it with a patient shrug, for sufferance is the badge of all our tribe." Please notice who keeps bringing up in this and in the opening scene the fact of the group he belongs to, it's Shylock. And yet we only see him at one time with any of the other Jews in Venice. It's Tubal, and we'll look at that scene in a moment. "You call me misbeliever, cutthroat dog, and spat upon my Jewish gabardine, and all for use of that which is mine own." It's very clear why the animosity. Now, clearly, a good Christian will not spit on anyone. This is a failing on Antonio's part by any objective standard. What is clear, however, is that the animosity is based on business matters. And I'll come to that in just a moment. What we're dealing with here is the question of usury. Hot topic at that time. "And all for use of that which is mine own." Well then, it now appears you need my help. Go to then. You come to me and you say, Shylock, we would have monies. You say so. You that did void your room upon my beard and foot me as you spur a stranger cur over your threshold. Monies is your suit? What should I say to you? Should I not say half a dog money? Is it possible a cur can lend 3,000 ducats? We have a little moment of humanity. You treated me that way about my business dealings? You call me a dog? Can a dog lend you money now that you need it? Huh? 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 What we have here is one of those Shakespearean moments where we have indeed a very real human drama. Shakespeare is rounding Shylock at that moment. That is a fair attack. You accuse me of being a moneylender. You accuse me of lending money for interest. Now you come to me and say, lend me money even if I have to pay interest. You call me a dog. Do dogs lend money? It's fair enough. It's fair enough. Now, I need to pause here for a moment and get into the question at hand, which is usury. As I said, a hot topic in the day. And why was it a hot topic? Because up until just shortly before the play was written, usury was strictly forbidden in England, as it was forbidden throughout most of the continent. You could not, according to church law or the law of government, receive interest on money that was loaned for a non-productive purpose. Got to draw that distinction right away. It's hugely important. Let me explain it this way. You come to me and say, I've got an idea for making really good sandals that I can make inexpensively. But I need the money to make the sand, to build a factory to make the sandals. Will you loan it to me? And I say, okay, here's the money to build the factory. You go build the factory, and you're turning out sandals, and you're selling millions of them a month. And making a fortune, because you've had the factory, built the sandals, and I go to you and say, I think since I gave you the money to help build the factory, I should get a cut of the sandal profits. That's fair. That's money that was loaned that became productive. Something came out of it. You made a huge profit out of it. And I have another example. I loan you the money to buy a house. You turn it into apartments and rent out the apartments. And they're luxury apartments and you're making huge sums of money from it. That loan is turned productive. I can say, look, you're making great rents off that and I loaned you the money. I think I should have some of it back. This is a fair exchange. If you are sick and need medication and you don't have the money and I go to you and I say, I need to buy some pills. Can't afford them. Will you give me the money? You give me the money, I get the pills, and you charge me 20% interest. It's non-productive. It is money making money because it's money. And it was forbidden. It was strictly forbidden. Let me explain it this way. According to the Old Testament laws, usury was permitted, except if you were Jewish and loaning money to a brother Jew. And then it was forbidden, because that was your brother. And you don't loan money to your brother and then make money out of it. My brother is needy, I'm loaning him the money, how much can I take him for? How much can I wring out of his hide? Uh-uh. You don't do that to a brother. Now, of course, we have then the incarnation, the coming of Christ, the establishing of the Christian order, and the question is very clear, who now is my brother? Everyone. I can no longer draw those distinctions. You're my brother and you're not. I have a special relationship with you. The rest of the world, forget it. All of a sudden, All men are my brothers, and therefore I cannot loan money to them and expect a high rate of interest to be repaid to me. It is unchristian. And for centuries it was forbidden by church and state. About 1570, so we're talking, what, 25 years before the play's written, in England, the following, and I quote, "All usury being forbidden by the law of God is sin and detestable. Even interest at 10% or under is forfeitable. All offenders shall also be punished and corrected according to the ecclesiastical laws." But notice that 10% or under. Well, there may be some occasions, but if we catch you at it, you have to give us the money. And if you persist in it, then we're really going to punish. But the idea is there. Okay, it suddenly come in. And all of a sudden, there's a new way of dealing with lending money. And that's, well, maybe you can get a little bit back on it, but it's absolutely sinful and detestable, and don't let us catch you at it, and no more than 10%. preferably less than 10%. So what I'm saying is, this is a topical piece. This play is topical in terms of the economic policies in England. And the fact of the matter is, the Jews were the moneylenders throughout the continent. So Shakespeare makes Shylock a Jew, a moneylender, and a miser. The money he makes is sealed up at home. Okay? And it's lent out very cautiously and at a high rate of interest, except for those Christians who are giving out money and charging no interest. Okay? He's angry at them for doing so, but please notice, Antonio's anger at Shylock is because of the fact he is loaning money at interest which is forbidden by the law of God and a sin and detestable, says a recent government decree in England. So that there is that sense. Very, very real and genuine anger. Let me take it from one other point of view. What have we got in this kind of money lending, in usury? We have, as I said, this goes back, and it certainly goes back to the time of Dante, around 1300. We're about 300 years earlier. Dante has the usurers in one of his circles of hell. And who does he have the usurers with? The homosexuals. Now, there's a curious combination for you. Why does Dante put the homosexuals and the usurers in the same circle of hell? Because he views them as both violating the order of nature. They are in the circles of the violent. And the homosexual does violence against nature by taking that which nature designed to be fruitful and making it barren. And the usurer is in the same circle because the usurer is committing violence against nature by taking that which in nature is barren, gold, silver, and making it fruitful. We have, if you will, two sides of a violation of nature. One in the misuse of the body that is meant to reproduce, and the other in the misuse of base metal that cannot reproduce. Gold cannot create more gold. It was not intended to. To do so is to violate its nature. Man was meant to reproduce. To have sexual relations and not reproduce is to violate nature by making it barren. It's perfectly logical. It's perfectly logical. And that's why Dante puts the two of them together. Shakespeare is fully aware of this. We get this, this curious statement that comes from Shylock. he is talking about, he gives the reference from Scripture. I'll just mark what Jacob did, okay? Antonio says, what, did Jacob take interest? Oh, no, no, not take interest. Not as you would say directly, interest. Mark what Jacob did. When Laban and himself were compromised that all the eanlings which were streaked and pied should fall as Jacob's hire, the ewes being rank in end of autumn turned into the rams. And when the work of generation was between these woolly breeders in the act, please notice what we're talking about, fertility in nature, okay? The skillful shepherd pilled me certain wands, and in the doing of the deed of kind, he stuck them up before the fulsome ewes, who then conceiving did in eating time fall party-colored lambs, and those were Jacob's. This was a way to thrive, and he was blessed. And thrift is blessing, if men steal it not. It is an example that is really stretching. Needless to say. Antonio says, this was a venture, sir, that Jacob served for, a thing not in his power to bring to pass, but swayed and fashioned by the hand of heaven. Heaven created those lambs that came out party-colored. Was this inserted to make interest good? What? Are you telling this story in defense of charging interest? Or is your gold and silver ewes and rams? Shylock says, I cannot tell. I make it breed as fast. And there it is. And that line went boom. What's he doing? Making fertile that which is infertile. He's making gold and silver like ewes and rams. Okay? Strictly, strictly forbidden for centuries. Strictly forbidden. He is violating nature. This is a great wrong. This is a great wrong. Okay? Now, my point here, I've gone on at length because I think this is extremely important to understand. The first thing is that what we have here is a character who announces himself as a villain in an aside at the beginning. I hate him. Okay, if I can get him, I'm really going to squash him. And then we see the reason. There's real animosity between these two characters, and the animosity has to do with an idea that was controversial at the time, and Shakespeare's presenting it on the stage. And Antonio is standing in defense of what the church had taught and what governments had enforced. And Shylock is doing something that, I will put it in Dante's terms, is against nature, but insisting on it, okay? And now he has a moment of catching Antonio because Antonio needs the money. But notice, what he's asking for again is not, hey, you give me lots of money back. No, no, let's make it this way. You don't repay me, I get a pound of your flesh. I get a pound of your flesh. I get something of nature, and I get to cut it wherever I want to cut it. It's sick. Bassanio says you won't do it. Antonio says, well, don't worry about it. It's not going to happen in any case. And of course it does. The scene should be very clear. There is animosity on both sides, but there's real hatred on one side. Shylock hates Antonio to the point of hoping to murder him. I don't think we can overlook this. This is villainy of a sort. Iago hates Othello, but Iago isn't out to kill Othello, and yet everyone says Iago is the greatest villain ever conceived. Shylock is out to kill Antonio, but it doesn't matter. We've got to overlook that, because he was spat on once. Won't wash.
This concludes the third CD. Please insert CD 4.